Korea has not been the only battleground since the end of the Second World War. Men have fought and died in Malaya, in Greece, in the Philippines, in Algeria, and Cuba, and Cyprus, and almost continuously on the Indo-Chinese Peninsula. No nuclear weapons have been fired. No massive nuclear retaliation has been considered appropriate. This is another type of warfare, new in its intensity, ancient in its origin, war by guerrillas, subversives, insurgents, assassins, war by ambush instead of by combat, by infiltration instead of aggression, seeking victory by eroding and exhausting the enemy instead of engaging him. It is a form of warfare uniquely adapted to what has been strangely called wars of liberation. To undermine the efforts of new and poor countries to maintain the freedom that they have finally achieved, it preys on economic unrest and ethnic conflicts. It requires, in those situations where we must counter it, you may hold a position of command with our special forces. Forces which are too unconventional to be called conventional. Forces which are growing in number and important and significant. And these are the kinds of challenges that will be before us in the next decade. If freedom is to be saved, it requires a whole new kind of strategy, a wholly different kind of force, and therefore a new and wholly different kind of military training.
We're going to be discussing China, Russia, and what their governments are doing to subvert United States influence around the world, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it, and where they're doing it. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I had on with me to discuss these topics and many more, H.P. Leffler. H.P. is a recently retired United States Army Green Beret. Served for 20 years as an 18 Bravo weapons sergeant and an 18 Fox intel sergeant. So we talked about unconventional warfare. We talked about the Russians. We talked about the Chinese. We talked about news media or fake news and, you know, ways that you can kind of get around that and try and get the best information possible. Meaning just the news and not a twist to it or not have it given to you from an angle to get a certain reaction. And we just talked about many things and, you know, what the public expects of the new type of war that we're fighting in this global war on terror in Afghanistan and elsewhere. But before we get into that, I just want to let you know that this podcast is sponsored by Abe's Bauman. For more than 20 years, the experienced attorneys have helped veterans across the country get the benefits they deserve. No one fights harder to protect the rights of veterans. Find out more at abesbauman.com/vets. That's A-B-E-S, Bauman, B-A-U-M-A-N-N.com/vets. They're doing great work over there. For any veterans listening, or if you know anybody in a situation where they might need some help, just go check them out. They have veteran attorneys, and they really do the right thing. So with that being said, now I will play the conversation that I had with H.P. Leffler. Hey, how's it going, man? Thanks for coming on.
Hey, no problem, brother. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so today is 9/11. For me, it feels like the anniversary of 9/11, just like it comes a little quicker each year. Typically, I would watch the ceremony on TV. I didn't catch it this year, but I'm not too far from the World Trade Center. I work not too far from there, so I have it in eyesight when I'm on the roof of the building. And it's just kind of a surreal thing. It really had such a profound effect on not only America, but the entire world, as it kind of set in motion what's been taking place for the last 16 years.
Yeah, definitely. Or at least it's made what's been going on much more visible to kind of everybody. I mean, this the struggle has been going on for a long, long time. But, you know, it's really been in the limelight since, you know, for the last 16 years.
And when you say struggle, are you referring to like the, you know, certain groups from the Middle East and Africa kind of, you know, fighting and conducting these type of attacks throughout the world?
Well, I mean, I think if you look, you know, there's been contention between the United States or the Western powers and, you know, radical, you know, Islamofascism, for lack of a better way of putting it. You know, I am certainly not condemning the entire Islamic faith. I think to do so is ignorant to the point of lunacy. But, you know, I mean, this struggle between, you know, between terrorism, especially Islamic terrorism, has been going on for a lot longer than September 11th. I mean, you can point to several, you know, several terrorist examples. It's just that September 11th hit home. September 11th had such a dramatic impact on the United States because it happened here, because so many of the casualties were, you know, your average American civilian just going to work, getting on an airplane, doing whatever, that, you know, it had a much more, you know, profound impact. But it certainly wasn't the opening bell. If anything, it was, you know, merely a kind of a, I guess, spectacular play in the game. But it definitely changed a lot of lives, myself included.
Yeah, there was definitely, I mean, like you said, there was a lot of things happening prior to that. But, you know, the U.S. government, you know, there were some guys like the, you had the first World Trade Center bombing, and they had like a small team of federal agents kind of tracking those guys down.
Mm-hmm.
And they happened to be connected to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the kind of the mastermind of the attack, or was involved in a lot of the planning and organizing of the 9/11 attacks. But it almost seems like they didn't take it. I'm not going to say they didn't take it seriously, but it wasn't at like the forefront of kind of a foreign policy for the political leadership, so to speak.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Clinton administration had different priorities. And, you know, again, I'm not trying to turn this into some political circus, but, you know, the Clinton administration had different priorities. The Clinton administration was, if you look at it from a certain point of view, the first post-Cold War presidential administration, and they had their policies were much more domestic in nature. And that's, you know, that's fine. It's just it didn't get the attention. And you know, it's easy to sit here with the benefit of hindsight and say, oh, they should have known.
Right.
You know, working in you know, in the intelligence world, doing these things is very much like trying to do a jigsaw puzzle while blindfolded. The problem is that you've got five jigsaw puzzles all in the same box, and you don't know until you take the blindfold off whether you've got everything right. So it's you know, it's easy, you know, 20/20 hindsight, oh, they should have known this, they should have known that, and they should have known whatever. And you know, of course, that's part of the lessons learned process. But yeah, I mean, there are certainly things that in retrospect we should have picked up on. But that, I mean, that can go all the way back to, you know, the Reagan administration and how we handled our withdrawal from Afghanistan, at the end of the Soviet occupation. You know, there's any number of things that we could have done differently, but our priorities were in the wrong place. The Reagan administration's priorities were the Soviet Union. Whatever happened anywhere else was a sideshow at best and a circus at worst. You know, the Clinton administration's priorities were much more domestic in nature. So something like international terrorism was not something that the Clinton administration was really prepared to engage. And, you know, we saw that in a number of, you know, a number of times. And then, you know, it kind of all came home to roost 16 years ago today. And the United States, for better and worse, and the world also for better and worse, has never been the same since.
Yeah, it really changed the kind of the way we view security and things like that. I mean, before, security at airports was, compared to now, was like nothing almost. And, you know, that's part of what the issue was. And, it's, you know, let's beef that up. And but, you know, like you said, a lot of these things have been happening, especially in like Africa and parts of the Middle East for a long time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's, you know, the Marine barracks bombing. The Khobar Towers attack, the attack on the American embassies. You know, hell, you could throw Pan Am, the Flight 103 bombing in there. You could throw, I mean, any number of terrorist incidents. The USS Cole, for example. All of these things going, I mean, the plane hijackings in the 80s. All of these things were viewed through the various lenses that we were looking at the world through, and it all, again, it all sort of came home to roost 16 years ago today.
Right. And now with the Trump getting elected and then this whole thing about there's a potential collusion with Russia, you know, people on the left they colluded. People on the right, no, it's not possible. But it does look like there's been relations have kind of soured with the Russian government. As the Russian government is, they're doing things globally to expand their power and influence. And the United States having the role that the United States has in the world, they're going to bump heads in a lot of different places as they have similar goals and maybe some similar methods to achieve them and some different. So, and then the same thing goes for China as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, there's been this a lot going on the last couple of years. This has kind of been brewing, I guess. And then it kind of came to light with the incidents in the Ukraine and the annexation of the Crimea. You know, it really kind of put Russia's neighbors on notice. And, you know, they've been kind of ramping up their military exercises and budgets and everything. You're kind of prepping for a worst case scenario type of deal.
Yeah. The Russians and the Chinese are going to have two distinctly different ways of approaching this. The Russians have a serious economic problem that has been a serious economic problem for Russia for as long as Russia's been Russia, in that they don't have a true warm weather port. And every single incident of Russian expansionism can be tied directly or indirectly to seeking that warm water port, especially on the Atlantic or with access to the Atlantic. Their move back into Crimea, their move back into Ukraine was an attempt. I mean, it was an attempt on several levels, but not insignificantly, was to reclaim the warm weather port that Stalin had given up to the Ukrainians when Ukraine was just another, you know, Russian or Soviet Federation. The other thing too is that the Russians, especially those who were influenced by a certain faction of the Soviet Empire and the Soviet machine, have a bit of, I don't want to call it an inferiority complex. I think that's too simple. I think they feel like they have something to prove, however, on the world stage. I think they feel like Russia in general and the Soviet Union kind of became the laughingstock of, you know, of the world. And when you look at the economic situation that Russia plunged into, and you look at, I mean, even continues, I mean, in Russia, in nowhere else in the world is there as much income disparity as there is in Russia, where something like 80% of the GNP in Russia is controlled by something like 5% of the people. So either you're a multi-billionaire oligarch or you're being paid a nickel a day to be someone's shoes. You know, they feel humiliated and they want to redeem themselves. They feel like they should be a great power and they want to redeem themselves. And Putin, I think, wants to be the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. And the only way he can do that, really do that, is by drawing the United States into a conventional up and up fight and beating us. So that's all of these things, you know, and I'm not a Russian analyst or anything. This is just how, you know, I look at the news and I see what's going on and I put these things together. And this is sort of what I've come up with. You know, they're playing a bit of long game.
Yeah.
They're playing a bit of, you know, they can't just roll the tanks into Western Europe and call it good. I mean, one, they're probably not really ready for that. And two, they have to position themselves to be geopolitically acceptable. They have to make it happen in such a way that at worst, the UN will just sort of say, oh, well, we got nothing to do with this. The Chinese, on the other hand, the concept of long game for the Russians and the concept of long game for the Chinese is wholly different. When you look at how tied into our economy they are, the only thing worse for the Chinese than losing in a war with us would be beating us in a war. So the Chinese, I don't think, want to fight. I think the Chinese are waiting. They're positioning themselves. They're moving the pieces. And they're waiting for us to collapse on our own, thus allowing them to win the war without firing a shot. You know, you've seen some extraordinarily brazen Chinese activity, the construction of the artificial islands in the South China Sea, for example.
Yeah.
You know, the blatant disregard of the international courts. The overt threatening of especially the Filipinos, you know, the Japanese, and quite frankly, from where I sit anyway, the Chinese are using they're using the North Koreans as a way to achieve what they want below the radar. They're using the North Koreans. The North Korean saber rattling continues and the Chinese are the ones benefiting from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you know, if you look at how the Chinese have done business, if you want to name a country that's benefited most from our continued involvement in Afghanistan, it's China. You know, with us being tied down in the region, you know, with us being bogged down in that, I mean, the Chinese, I mean, if you really look at when the surge forward in all of this activity in China started, it started when, you know, while we were in bogged down in Afghanistan. So, You know, those two are very definitely things. I think we're most likely to see, you know, to see shots fired in Europe, especially once the Russian-Chinese natural gas pipeline is completed. You know, I think that will allow the Russians to turn off natural gas to Western Europe without economic consequence to themselves. And I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be a very interesting time to be alive, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I know, you know, out of all the world leaders, I mean, obviously for any world leader, you need to have, if you want to be successful, you have to, you know, be a smart person or have some decent amount of intelligence, but you also need to have a good team around you of advisors and everything. But I think in a singular sense, I think Putin is probably pretty sharp individually, you know, given his background and his training and everything. And I think you hit it on the head when you said that, you know, there's some sort of almost like inferiority complex there where they feel like they need to prove themselves to the world. And I forget what it was. It might have been a reporter with Time Magazine. I don't remember exactly. But a couple of years ago, they spent, you know, some time with Putin, you know, as he done whatever he does, you know, in his kind of daily activities.
You mean riding a bear?
Yeah,
exactly. Through the forest with no shirt on, firing an AK-47. Yeah,
yeah. And what he said was what he felt like after, you know, he kind of looked back on his time there and, you know, looking over his notes and everything they'd done in terms of interviewing and whatnot, is that he got the impression that Putin feels like the West kind of looks down on Russia, and he felt like that is like the single most infuriating thing to Vladimir Putin, you know, as a person. And thus that kind of pushes a lot of his activities or his thinking and how he should engage the West or whatever. And then on China, everything you listed was I think pretty accurate, and I agree, but as well as they were doing a lot of like cyber attacks on American companies and like stealing information. I think there was like a DOD hack a while ago. Where, you know, a lot of information was made available to hackers, and I think they really play the long game, and or at least they're attempting and they're positioning themselves well to do that. Especially like you said with the islands that they're building, and they're putting like, you know, military bases on them. They're having issues with some of those smaller Southeast and East Asian countries like Vietnam, like the Philippines. But I know recently with the Filipino president, they've kind of made some ground in having better relations, right?
I haven't seen that. I'm not saying it's not possible. You know, if it's recent in the news, I may have missed it.
Or at least,
I'm having a real hard time with the news these days because
right.
I just, you know, you turn on the news and it's, you know, any of your mainstream news sources, it's, you know, anti-Trump shrieking. And then you turn on, you know, your other option and it's fawning adoration, and I don't really want either of those things.
Right.
So I tend to watch Good Morning Football in the morning.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting point, you know, on the news thing. It's like at this point to get good information, you kind of have to go to a bunch of different places and just piece together the picture yourself or the puzzle yourself, you know?
Yeah. Well, my dad tells a story and I don't know where he heard it or if it's true or allegorical. But, you know, a Supreme Court justice was asked when he gets to the office every day, what's the first piece of paper? You know, what's the first piece of the newspaper that he looks at? And he says the sports section, you know, and the interviewer was confused. And, well, what do you mean with all these things going on in the world and you're a Supreme Court justice? Shouldn't you be paying a little bit more attention to this or to that or whatever else? And the Supreme Court justice says, well, in the sports section, it's the only section of the paper where the journalists are actually still trying to do their job. And that, you know, unfortunately, that's how I see it. So I watch Good Morning Football in the morning and then I go to the gym.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's gotten to a point where it's like objectivity is frowned upon, you know, like you can't have an opinion about something and that be your opinion on that specific subject. Like if you say XYZ about something, or you're a liberal, or if you say XYZ about this, then you're thrown on the conservative right wing, group. So it's kind of, I guess, sad in a way, you know, we've kind of gotten to this point, you know, this climate. I put up a post on social media about 9/11 and, you know, kind of remembering from that, you know, my time on that day when it happened, because I was in Manhattan when it happened. Mm-hmm. And I think I was like in seventh grade or something like that, eighth grade, I don't remember. But, you know, I remember thinking like, this is crazy. Like, I can't even believe this is happening, right? And then there's so much like negative that comes with it. You know, people are they can't contact their loved ones. People are missing, you know, families are feeling the worst, that kind of thing. But there was some positive to it in how people came together. And I think as a country, we need leadership that at least will attempt to guide us in a direction of unity, versus kind of separating us, you know, and it's difficult with today's political climate, but.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I take great solace in the understanding that on December 6th, 1941, the greatest generation of Americans was just as divided, just as scared, just as everything else as we seem to be. And while the unity that generation managed to achieve lasted significantly longer than the unity that our generation was able to achieve, a lot of that had to do with, I mean, a lot of that had to do with the fact that that generation, the unity they managed to achieve, saw them at the end of the day with an unequivocal victory. And the nature of warfare, no longer being the exclusive province of the nation state, has led to, I mean, you're not, unequivocal victories, that's not going to be a thing. You know, how do you, you know, in the era of, you know, in the era of, you know, geopolitical do-gooding, for lack of a better way of putting it, you can't just roll in, you know, crush your enemies, see them driven before you and hear the lamentations of the women, and then go back home, have a you know, a shot of bourbon and smoke a cigar and call it a day. That's not the way the world works anymore. That's not the way war is anymore. And so, you know, this concept of this unequivocal victory, it's like trying to hold sand.
Yeah.
And I don't think the national psyche has adapted to that. I think there's a large amount of misunderstanding about the nature of modern war that leads to a lot of frustration, especially on the part of people who aren't involved. And so it's a very difficult cocktail to come up with. How do we do this? How do we achieve this victory? Because I think I really want to believe that America is everything we've been promised that it is. I would really like to believe that all of this stuff going on is just growing pains. It's just, it's a frustration with a lack of clear victory. It's a whatever. But it kind of feels like it might be more than that. And you know, we'll, I guess time will tell.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point about kind of the understanding of victory and what it means. I mean, you know, like you said, the days of nation versus nation warfare is kind of over. I mean, not that it's necessarily over, as a larger war couldn't happen, but mm-hmm. you know, what's been going on really has been small conflicts, and you're absolutely right. I think people just need to understand certain realities of that kind of warfare, but being so far removed from it in terms of a very small amount of people serving in the military, and then, you know, the news media kind of showing what they want about it, kind of angling a certain thing a certain way to get a certain reaction. I think that really kind of throws things off. And
oh, absolutely. I mean, the news media, quite frankly, should be ashamed of themselves. And that's, it's been going on for a while, and you know, it's especially bad now. But much like any other organization like that, they're not going to accept external criticism. You know, that's that criticism. They're going to have to figure that out for themselves. And I think the only way they're going to is if we, the people, all just stop watching and listening and reading. But what, you know, that's A, not likely, and B, where does that leave us? That leaves us even more uneducated about the world that we live in than we currently are. So I don't know. Maybe what it needs is a new generation of journalists. You know, maybe journalism needs to no longer be the exclusive calling of, you know, of American leftists. You know, maybe it calls for, you know, maybe the answer is large investment in mainstream media by people who are maybe not so left-leaning in order to affect the editorial boards. Who knows? But it's I would very much like to see the media come back to a much more centrist, or at least be professionally centrist. Whether their personal political alliances lie on the left or the right, you know, that's not the job of a reporter, is not to take sides. It's to report the news.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, is that kind of the opinion aspect of it, or piece of it, it has really kind of taken over, versus just saying, hey, this happened, you know, X and Y happened, and you know, we'll see you tomorrow night.
Yep.
So kind of moving forward, mm-hmm. you served for a number of years in the United States Army. Can we talk about some of that? Like, where did you start your career, and where did you end up?
Absolutely. I started my career as an 11 X-ray with airborne option at Fort Benning, Georgia, on October 2nd, 1995. I'd been shown the door at the University of Minnesota, and informed that, you know, apparently there was more expected of me than sitting around my dorm room drinking beer and chasing women. And so I enlisted. I've never really had the conversation with my parents about how that was received. I know it's not what they sort of hoped would happen. I think my mother especially would have preferred that I move home, stay in my room, go to the community college, get my grades back up, and then go somewhere else and finish my degree and go on to great and glorious things. That was not how I saw it, however. I went and joined the Army and wanted to be in Ranger Regiment. And unfortunately, in 1995, there weren't slots in Ranger Regiment for infantrymen. And so I ended up in the 82nd Airborne Division. I ended up as 11 Charlie, an indirect fire infantryman, which, well, I didn't enjoy it at the time, definitely set me up for things to come. I changed my MOS to 11 Bravo and PCS to Fort Richards in Alaska, where I was in 1st Battalion, 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment. And after that, I'd sort of decided to hang it up. And on, again, 16 years ago today, I was on leave between Fort Richardson and going back to Fort Bragg for what I truly thought were going to be my last 18 months in the Army. And the phone rings at about, I don't know, 6 in the morning. And it's my grandmother. And I answer, I'm like, hello. She says, a plane flew into the World Trade Center. We're under attack. Well, like probably most of everybody else who heard it before they saw anything about it, I assumed it was a drunken Red Sox fan and a Piper Cub or something. So I told her, I said, Grandma, I'm sure we're not under attack. She says, well, get up and look from the news yourself, dumbass. And then hung up on me. This is the nature of my family. And so I got up just in time to watch a second plane hit. And, you know, I knew right then and there that my world had changed. I didn't know the magnitude of it yet. I couldn't even conceive of the magnitude of it yet. Spent all day standing in line with my dad to try and give blood. They took my dad's blood, but when they found out I was in the service, they told me that they figured mine would be needed right where it was. And I grabbed my orders and found the phone number that you're supposed to call if you have an issue. And I called it and I was like, hey, you know, I'm on orders to the 82nd. Do I need to report in like now? And the voice on the other end of the phone said, no, everybody, you know, the Army knows where you are. If they need you to get there, you know, they'll get a hold of you. And, you know, of course, you know, in retrospect, the hubris that is required to call the Army. And it's like, do you need me to show up so we can go to war now? Is absolutely mind numbing. Yeah. Like yes.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Leffler. Yeah. Yes. Specialist Leffler, the entire airborne establishment cannot swing into action until you get your ass in the saddle. So would you kindly heed the call of the trumpet, please? Man, it's ridiculous. So I reported to Bragg and, I mean, it was insane. Like entire platoons of riflemen at every gate. Everything was locked down. It was like the entire post lost its mind. And then I got there and there was like, oh, we're going to do expert infantryman's badge training. And I just looked at my boss and I was like, what? No, we're going to go to the range and we're going to train and we're going to deploy and swing the bat for Jesus. That's what we're going to do. He's like, no, we're going to do EIB training. I'm like, okay, all right, well, okay. And then shortly after that, we started sending troops to Afghanistan, and I'm sitting at Fort Bragg. And on the day that Operation Anaconda kicked off in the Tora Bora Mountains, I was on Fort Bragg picking up garbage in training area hotel, which based on the garbage I was picking up had not been used since World War II. M1 Garand stripper clips and Thompson submachine gun magazines and sea ration cans. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Oh, sis.
Yeah. And so that next day, I told my – that afternoon, actually, I told my boss, I said, hey, I'm not going to be at work tomorrow. And she's like, oh, on the contrary, my friend, you are. And I said, no, I'm going to go do my SF physical. I've had enough of this. So I went and did my physical. And in February of 2002, I went to Special Forces selection, followed by the Q course. I graduated as an 18 Bravo Weapons NCO and was sent to 10th Group at Fort Carson, Colorado. Did three tours to Iraq there. Then was assigned as a survival instructor and eventually the survival detachment non-commissioned officer in charge at the SEER school at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School. After that, I had the opportunity to serve with 1st Battalion, 10th Group in Stuttgart, Germany. My boss at SEER had gotten he was a 10th Group guy, and he had gotten a company to be the sergeant major of in Germany. And he came to me and said, hey, you want to come to Germany with me? I hadn't really thought of that at the time. At the time, I was looking forward to getting back to Colorado. But it occurred to me, I was like, you know, when I'm 60, I don't want to be able to look in the mirror and tell myself, you had the opportunity to live in Europe and you didn't do it.
Right.
So I got to Germany. And everything I thought would be the case about Germany was not. I kind of thought it'd be just like America, but in German, no. So it took a bit of getting used to. I was supposed to be on, let me back up. When I got to Germany and I reported in, most of the company was in Afghanistan, because 110 was supporting the ISAF soft mission. And we were working with, you know, other European special operations units with ISAF in Afghanistan. But one of the teams that was spinning up to deploy, the team sergeant was Daniel Slim Adams. And Dan Adams had been a 3rd Group guy, but he and I had served together in the 501st in Alaska, and so we knew each other. And I showed up in the company. I was an experienced 18 Bravo. He had a very young team. And he asked me if I would be his senior weapons guy. And I said, yeah, of course. I'm just going to need a couple weeks to get my, you know, to settle my affairs. And he said, okay. And we, you know, we started everything down that path. And I started getting the team's weapons stuff set. And then he calls me up one day and he says, hey, the sergeant major has spoken. He's like, you're a Halo jump master. Halo jump masters go to Halo teams. So you're going to be on 2-4, you know, thanks, man. And I was like, I'm sorry. And then 10 days after that, actually on September 13th, Slim Adams was killed in Afghanistan.
Oh, wow.
Which was kind of a kick in the nuts. And so I was the senior weapons guy for a while on ODA 024 using the old numbering system. The new numbering system would be ODA 0124. And then Sergeant Major comes to me and says, hey, Lef, we're really short on 18 Foxes. And I said, okay. He says, would you consider going to the 18 Fox course? And I said, sure, I'll go to the 18 Fox course. So I went back to North Carolina for 4.5 months for the 18 Fox course, came back, deployed, and then the team was already gone. I immediately deployed to Afghanistan. Came back from Afghanistan and pretty much turned right around and went back to Afghanistan to do some other stuff. And then came back. Was in Germany the rest of the time in Germany, and then took an assignment to be an ROTC instructor. I thought it would be something different. I thought it would be something new. I thought it would be an opportunity to kind of chill out. And it was definitely different. I thought I was going to have a very tangible and positive impact on the next generation of junior officers. I guess time will tell if I was successful in that. But while I was there, I made the decision that I'd had quite enough of this. Thank you very much. And decided to retire. And as of 1 September, 10 days ago, I am now retired from the Army.
Oh, right. I remember you in the process, man. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, man.
So what's that a total of how many years in?
21 years, 10 months, so many days. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a long time. And you know, especially being in Special Forces, you know, when we're talking about understanding, you know, the nature of the conflict of what we're fighting today and whatnot, that's kind of the bread and butter of what Green Berets do. And just a quick question, the you going back to the 18 Fox course, is that kind of unusual for a guy who's already, you know, had a couple of deployments and whatnot?
No, not at all. In fact, 18 Fox is not a basic Special Forces MOS. So you have to, you know, you go to selection and you go to the Q course in one of the four basic MOSs. And then if you want to be an 18 Fox, you then have to go back to the course.
Okay. I didn't know.
You know, afterwards.
So, okay, yeah. So as a, you know, as a Green Beret and you know, multiple deployments, I guess Iraq, Afghanistan are a little bit different in the nature of, you know, fighting over there or whatnot. But
absolutely,
you know, what you guys specialize in specifically Green Berets is unconventional warfare and, you know, countering or empowering groups in countries where there's conflict.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what the conflict is today is really just unconventional warfare. Small groups of individuals, they fire a shot, drop their rifle, blend in with the local populace. It's a different kind of ball game from what they were doing in World War II or even Korea. I guess Vietnam was kind of the beginning of that fighting style, but also the terrain in Vietnam made it unique in itself.
Well, actually, guerrilla warfare, unconventional warfare is much older than that. Yeah.
Right.
And Special Forces actually gets its start from the Jedburghs and the OGs and the Detachment 101 and 202 of the Office of Strategic Services.
Right.
It's a lot easier to be the guerrilla than it is to try and counter it.
Right.
You know, you really need to understand the culture that you're dealing with. And that it's one thing to understand, say, the French or the Belgians, or, you know, it's a whole other ballgame to try to understand, you know, the Iraqis or the Afghans. You know, especially getting involved in an internal struggle. It's not like, you know, it's not like even dealing with Afghanistan in the 80s where we were helping them throw the Soviets out. It's not like jumping into France to help them throw out the Germans. I mean, this was the stuff going on in, I mean, we were the invaders. We were the ones that they were going to see as, you know, as the army of occupation. So to even, I mean, honestly, to achieve what we did is nothing short of remarkable. We did a lot of things right in Afghanistan, a lot of things wrong, but a lot of things right. And I guess if there's one thing that I hope we can take from our experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan is that we, even if it's just on the special operations side of the house, can take the lessons we learned there and apply them going forward. Expecting, you know, expecting the big time decision makers at DOD level to do that is probably asking too much. But, you know, hope springs eternal in the human heart.
Yeah, and that's part of the issue is some of the in some regards, the top down approach isn't quite the right approach versus, you know, the bottom up approach where the guy on the ground, say the, you know, special forces captain, who's trained in that type of warfare for his entire career, and then is fighting it on the ground. I mean, there were examples of successful unconventional warfare strategies early on in the Afghanistan war and throughout it. But I remember it, like maybe it was at 2002 or like really early, where ODAs were having major success living in villages with alongside the Afghanis and training them and countering the Taliban, not just by gunfighting, although that was a part of it, but also by working with the local population, figuring out what they needed, you know, helping rebuild the towns and that kind of thing. And it was really effective. And then I think some of it kind of changed up when it became a, you know, we're doing this way, no matter what you say. And that kind of threw things off in a way.
Well, there is a book written by, and I can't remember his name, Garnier maybe. But he'd been the CIA station chief in Islamabad, Pakistan from 1999 to 2002. And he states that there was essentially two separate American-Afghan wars. The first one was a ringing success for the United States and the Western allies. And in that one, we saw the marriage of special operations and, you know, paramilitary forces of the intelligence community, kind of coupled with American precision air power in order to achieve these great things. The book is titled 88 Days to Kandahar. And it references the fact that 88 days after September 11th, we had kicked the Taliban out of Kandahar. And that things started to go sideways once we started committing, you know, conventional American combat troops to the, you know, to the contest. I don't know, you know, I mean, obviously he was in a much better position to observe this than I was. But, and you know, frankly, by the time I got to Afghanistan, it was the way it was. So it was it's very difficult to, you know, to say that, yes, there was better then or better, whatever. I mean, it's just tough to tell. I don't have the pedigree to start making commentary about, you know, decisions at that level or the, you know, the nature of the fight. All I know is that when I was in Afghanistan, the Afghans knew we were leaving and they treated us like they knew we were leaving. And so it was very difficult to accomplish anything, especially things that we needed Afghan cooperation for, because they knew we were leaving.
Right. So to them, it's just like, you know, why am I going to risk everything when these guys are going to leave at some point and I still have to stay here and deal with these guys?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and not only that, I think that in both Iraq and Afghanistan, Afghanistan is the more glaring example. We expected too much too fast. I mean, the way I put it is this. From the day that Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown until the time the United States could say that we are a reasonable, self-governing nation state was about 100 years. 100 years on when we had the whole continent to ourselves. And again, I'm not going to get into, you know, how Native Americans were treated. I'm keeping this at the, you know, I'm keeping this at the big conceptual level now. We had a continent all to ourselves. We had all the natural resources we could possibly imagine. We had all the room we needed. Americans were at least as well educated as anybody else was anywhere else in the world. We had better food. We were healthier. And it took us 100 years. We expect a country with, at least in the case of Afghanistan, 3% mean literacy rate. In the face of the most malignant insurgency the world has ever seen, with, I mean, they have natural resources, but they can't access them.
Right.
To stand up a Jeffersonian democracy in a decade? Oh, okay. This makes sense. And when they were unable to do that, or unwilling to do that, or whatever, we chose to view that as them, I don't know, not being grateful to us, not being whatever, and enthusiasm for the effort in Afghanistan, you know, waned quickly. And so I think we reached too far. I think we tried to impose too much of our cultural norms on their culture. You know, you don't turn the Titanic on a dime. Cultures don't change overnight. And so, you know, every single thing that we did, maybe even especially the things that we did with the most benign intent, were viewed by some of the Afghans that we probably could have won over as threats to their culture. And therefore, which is one of the reasons why we were never really able to stomp out the Taliban and to, you know, we never won the war of ideals because we didn't understand the language in which the Afghans needed to be engaged. You know, we didn't understand the way in which support for what we were trying to do could be won. And that's unfortunate because, I mean, we dumped a lot of money into Afghanistan. We lost a lot of people in Afghanistan. And, I mean, things are still going on in Afghanistan. So.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting because when after the towers fell and the Bush administration, they said, you know, we're going to embark on a global campaign to rid the world of what we're calling terrorism, right? This, you know, all these groups, there's loose alliances, but they're all rooted in the same evil ideology, and we're going to go after them. And part of the entire kind of underlying theme of it was that everything would be like quick, like it would be fast. We'll go in, hit them hard, and pull out. And I think, you know, when you were earlier when we were talking about people not understanding the nature of the conflict, I think you just really hit it on the head because, like you said, it took America decades and decades and decades to finally come to a point where, you know, we figured it out, or at least to a certain degree. And then on top of that, you have these people of Afghanistan, the Pashtuns, they're like they are the oldest tribal group on the planet that's still around. So these people have customs and ways of living that are way older than the United States. And it's like, it's hard enough to get things going for what our version of what a country should be and freedom should be in a democracy, right? But to then impart that on a group of people that have been around for way longer than we have and are kind of steeped in their way of life, it really was unrealistic. And I think that's where we kind of met problems in Afghanistan. And again, it's just what we're kind of continuing on this path. It's like, are we ready for a commitment that could take, you know, years? You know, we're talking, you know, 50 years, 60 years. I don't think we are. And then, so then the question becomes, what are we still doing there? And then it becomes, you know, politics get involved and that kind of thing. So it's really tricky. And hopefully some of the people advising the president understand some of these things.
Yeah. Well, I guess we will see. You know, it's one thing to say, hey, I hope this happens. It's a whole other ballgame to, you know, for it to happen. You know, well, I guess we'll see. I mean, there are people out there who are brilliant in these areas. And it would be really nice to see, it'd be really nice to see the president or any president engage their services or listen to them. I mean, a lot of these people are still in uniform, so they technically already work for the government. But, you know, that's now we're talking about things that are so far beyond my pay grade and so far beyond anything that I have any experience in that now, you know, now we might as well be talking about lightsaber design. I mean, whatever. <you're in. laughs>
Okay. So kind of moving forward now, would you be okay with sharing a story with the audience from your time in the service? Could be a time that you were deployed or in training or something that was kind of profound to you?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I don't really have a lot of I don't have a lot of really good stories. But, you know, for people listening who are just starting out in the military or who are considering a military career, I will say that one of the things you will find is that you will learn a new definition of the word ridiculous. And by that, I don't necessarily mean all the stupid stuff you're going to have to deal with. I mean, there'll be plenty of that. But you will find yourself sitting at a bar one day thinking about the day you just had and realizing that was some of the most insane whatever it was that you can imagine. And then you'll go to work the next day and, you know, Specialist Schmuckatelli will do something even more insane. Or, you know, your boss will say something just when you think you've heard the dumbest thing that the world has ever heard. Your boss will say something that is even dumber, or the private that you're completely convinced was born and raised under high tension power lines will say to you the most profound and amazingly intelligent thing you've ever heard another human being utter in your life. And it'll turn out that private isn't stupid. He's just a whole lot smarter than you are. You will find friendships that right now you can't even imagine. And for every day, and you know, for every day that you sit and wonder, like, what the hell am I doing this for? There will be a day where you'll look around and nod your head and be like, yes. You know, I tell people all the time, and I guess here's a good story. The guy, when I was in Colorado, there's a guy that lived down the hall from me. After I sold my house and was living in an apartment, and he was the manager of a cell phone store somewhere in town. I don't know which one, and I don't really care. But he asked me, because he never saw me in uniform. He asked me what I did for a living. I told him I was in the Army. And he's like, oh, I can never be in the Army. I said, why not? He's like, oh, too many people tell me what to do. I said, yeah, you're right. Nobody tells you what to do in your job.
Yeah.
And he kind of looked at me funny. And then, you know, I'd see him about every few days. And he'd ask, like, and it just kind of worked out really well, because he'd always ask me, like, oh, so what'd you do at work today? You know, and at first it started out like with this hint of sort of derisive sarcasm. What'd you do at work today? March all day? I was like, no, I spent all day jumping out of airplanes. What? Yeah. We woke up this morning. We flew down to Arizona. We jumped all day and we flew back. I grabbed a six pack on my way home, and I'm going to sit on my porch and watch the sunset over the mountains and drink it. What? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you know, a couple days later, what'd you do today? Well, I spent all day on the demo range blowing stuff up. What? Yeah. Like, all right, I spent all day shooting. I did this. I did that. And it really gives you an entirely different perspective. You know, for all the constraints of military service, I have been more free in my time in the military than most people can possibly imagine. I mean, I've driven the Silk Road. I've seen 500-year-old monasteries. I've met some of the most amazing people. Yeah, there's been heartbreak. There's been horror. There's been all sorts of stuff. I've bled. I've sweat. I've cried. But at the end of the day, you know, the career I had in the military is the most amazing thing that it defies description. And, you know, for those of you who are just starting out, for those of you who are still cleaning latrines and mopping the floor, and or who are officer cadets, or who are the assistant officer in charge of, you know, urine sample collection in addition to all your other duties, and you're wondering why the hell you agreed to do this, stick with it. It gets better. And quite frankly, the nation needs you way more than the nation believes that it does. It, you know, General Mattis just recently said, you know, stick to your guns. You know, the eventually the country will sort itself out. And once they do, just stick to your guns. It's a way better life than right now, you PFC who had a crappy day at work and got yelled at by his, you know, squad leader, and is spending the week, you know, spend this weekend cleaning toilets. You know, you brand new second lieutenant who didn't get the assignment you wanted and think the world is over. I promise you, it will get better, and it is the most worth it thing you can imagine. So that's what I would say. That's the story I would tell. You know, nobody, and I think that's a better way to approach it than, you know, so there I was, 10,000 feet and falling fast, nothing between me and the earth but a thin blonde. I mean, nobody, you know, that's not what's important. What's important is, you know, hey, you know, you know, kid who is frustrated by the fact that it's not all, you know, it's not all, you know, lap dances and unicorns, you know, just stick with it, because it will get better.
I'm glad you took that approach, because that right there could have a positive impact on someone who's listening, you know, and you say, you know what, he's right. And I'll also add on to that is, not only does that apply to military service, but to almost anything in life.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of having that will to continue on and like you said, stick with your guns. And that really, even when things, it just seems like, no, this is impossible. This is not going to work out, whether you're starting a business or anything. And it does get better, I think. And I people just kind of have to be reminded of that once in a while. Because, you know, life is hard enough with things that you go through. Some people are born into difficult situations, and then some people experience, you know, difficulty throughout life. And I think it's good to have a reminder once in a while that things will work itself out if you stay the course. And and kind of speaking of Mattis, General Mattis, do you think he's one of the people who kind of really know what they're doing and understand the conflict, the nature of the conflict?
I don't know. I want to say yes, based on his pacification of Anbar province in Iraq. But I really don't know. I think that Mattis was an absolutely brilliant choice for Secretary of Defense. The only other job that I can really think of that might have been even better for him would have been National Security Advisor. But I think I want to say yes, but I don't know General Mattis. I have never spoken to him. We have never had any conversation on any of these issues. And I was never in the Marines. So his decisions and his policies never, like, I never had to implement them.
Right.
So it was it was one of those things where I certainly would like to think so. And his pacification of Anbar province was by all, was brilliant. He doesn't have a special operations background that I'm aware of, but that doesn't really mean anything either. Like, you don't need to be a pilot to understand how an airfoil works. You don't need to be a nuclear engineer to understand that you're getting power in your house from a nuclear power plant. So, I realize I'm hemming and hawing about this, but I would really like to believe so. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, right. In the regards of, you need to, could people have opinions on things, right? So, people talk about all kind of things and where they don't necessarily know the person and that kind of thing. And I get it. And, but yeah, he does, in my opinion, I think he appears to understand it to an extent. And when you say the pacification of Anbar, are you referring to not only the military action taken there, but the, what's kind of referred to as like the Anbar awakening?
Definitely. And I think he handled it well, from the military perspective, the conversation and I don't know, this has all been blown, the stories have gone around and around and around to the point that it's impossible to know what the actual facts of the matter were. But, I come in peace. I've brought no artillery. And I'm begging you with tears in my eyes, if you fuck with me, I will kill you all.
Yeah.
That's warrior diplomacy. That's speaking to a group of people on a level that they understand, which is the biggest part of warrior diplomacy, of course. And the bottom line is that until General Mattis got to Anbar, no one else on the American side of the argument was able to make even a dent. Now, I don't, that may just have been because nobody else was willing to look at these tribal leaders and say, I will kill you if you keep messing with me. Or what? Because again, I'm not present at any of these things. I have no visibility on it. So I don't know why the others were failing and why General Mattis succeeded. All I know is that everyone else failed and he succeeded.
Right. So you just officially retired a couple of days ago, but that process is kind of ongoing, right? It takes a couple of months, or I believe so. And you have what it appears to me to be like a passion, and you're kind of working towards something. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you do 22 years doing what I've been doing, like, you need a little bit of downtime. I still enjoy training. I like to go to the gym. I like to go to the range. I like to do all this stuff. And right now, I'm just kind of trying to get my feet on the ground to adjust to life within a society that has changed so dramatically since I stepped out of it. So I like getting out in the woods, man. I like loading up my truck and getting away and kind of finding some of that peace and finding, you know, it's challenging myself in sort of a different way. You know, if you've never taken a vehicle that you're still paying for and have to drive around every day on a fairly challenging off-road trail, then, you know, for those of you in that boat, I promise you it's a lot more challenging than you think, because, you know, the consequences are much more dire than they are if it's some beater or whatever. So I enjoy doing that. And right now I'm just sort of focused on, you know, I'm getting my foot in the door. But I love to teach. And I think I have a lot of experience that I can bring to bear that can put me in a good position to help others out, whether that's, you know, people who are just starting in their military careers or people who want to learn some of these skill sets. You know, or whether it's the, you know, looking at some of the, like, the nonprofit work and like that others in my lineage have done. So I'm still kind of figuring it out, but I know that I'm not 100% ready to put the gun belt down yet. I'm not ready for the cardigan sweater and the rocking chair yet. So I definitely have a passion for doing these things. It's just, you know, right now I'm focused on kind of getting my feet on the ground and figuring out what direction I'm going to go, and then figuring out a way to kind of put all that stuff together, if that makes sense.
No, it does. Absolutely.
You know, it's a pretty big shift. You know, and I have to take my hat off to a lot of the, you know, a lot of the guys that have gone before me that have made these successful transitions and have started these companies and are doing great things. You know, Aaron at Guerrilla Approach, and you know, Lauren and Brian with you know, the stuff they're doing. It's just brilliant. And so, you know, as I move forward and I start getting more ready to look into that for myself, I definitely want to, you know, reach out to those cats and see how they, you know, see how they kind of got started. And, you know, again, there's no need, as we say often, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. Right. You know, maybe I'll just put spinner hubcaps on mine. Who knows? But, you know, I definitely want to be, you know, I also tend to look back to people who have gone before me in the transition. A lot of times I tend to look back to the Office of Strategic Services and the JEDs and the OGs for, you know, my ideas on, you know, for concepts on how I want to be going forward, now that my time in the sun is over. And, you know, I look at these dudes, and these dudes were, you know, ambassadors and college professors, yeah, and, you know, directors of Central Intelligence and all of these things. And I just, yeah, you know, I, at the end of the day, and this might sound a little corny, but when I shake these guys' hands in Valhalla, I don't want to be embarrassed with the person that they see in front of them. And so, you know, again, I'm not really prepared to tell you specifically, like, oh, hey, you know, look for me, I'll be at SHOT, look for da 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 da. But I mean, there's more stuff coming for me. It's just a question of figuring out what that's going to look like and how that's going to go. And I know that may not be exactly, you know, the answer you had in mind, but I can't give you any more specifics than that. Right now I'm looking at putting rock sliders and a roof rack on my truck and spending a few days up in the North Woods, my home state of Minnesota, and taking in a Gopher football game this weekend, and, you know, and going and hopefully watching the hopefully watching the Vikings stick it to the Saints here in a few minutes.
Oh yeah, that's coming up. Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, no, I appreciate that kind of response, because when I listen to you say that, it's demonstrating like you're kind of breaking down your thought process and the way you're looking at it. And I think the part about where you're shaking hands with the guys who went before you, and you want to kind of stand proud, because obviously you serve, so you guys have that in common, and then you want to equally affect and stand proud post military. I mean, I think that's a great motivation, and for anyone listening, I hopefully you can take some lessons from that in regards to how you want to move forward in life, right? Like you need some type of motivation, and I think looking back at history, and it's something that I do myself, you know. So I kind of feel you on that. I think the way you go about things is, you know, as important as the end result. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It absolutely does. You know, there's an argument to be made for the ends justify the means. And that may be true in certain circumstances and in certain, you know, certain events. But if you build your life on that, I think you're going to find that you won't be the person looking back at you in the mirror won't be the person that you want to be looking back at you in the mirror. And, you know, it's one thing to justify that in your mind if it's a, you know, some one specific instance, but if, you know, it matters how you got to where you're at. It may not matter to others, but you can lie to everybody in the world. You can't lie to yourself. If you have to ask yourself, is this the right thing to do? Then the answer is almost certainly no, it is not. And so I'm very much trying to keep that in mind also. And honestly, just to kind of keep the faith, you know, I mean, you spend a long time doing something where there's a path for you. And yeah, you have a certain amount of self-control over how you navigate that path or the directions you want that path to take you. But at the end of the day, it's all very structured and you know this. And then you get spit out the ass end. And, you know, you look around and the things that we in the service value and the things that we in the service have come to be taught are important, nobody else really seems to care about. You know, for all the, oh, thank you for your service, and it can be a scary place on the outside. And so taking, you know, for those of you, just like I talked to people who are just starting their careers or just contemplating a military career, for those of you who are freshly out or are about to be out, and maybe the world didn't align the way you thought it would, because Lord knows it didn't for me. I never for a second thought I wouldn't be walking away from the military without a job in hand. I never for a second believed that I truly believed when I was told that employers would come beating down my door to hire me. And you know, in retrospect, it's like, that's ridiculous. No, they're not. But you know, for those of you out there who are getting towards the ass end of your career, it's you know, it's scary, but leap in the net will appear. Don't make a hasty decision to get out, but by the same token, don't stay in just because you're afraid to do something different. Get out, get yourself settled, figure out your direction, and then go. You know, in SF, we say all the time, you know your operational environment. Take the time to learn your operational environment once you get out.
Yeah, you know, from all the conversations I have, I talk to a lot of different people from your community, your similar background, and as you know, I do a lot of reading on history, and I believe you do as well. I think almost everything that we go through, except in some instances where there's newer technology and newer ways to do things, all of these things have happened before in some way, shape, or form. The information is out there for you to learn them or learn that. I think applying some of those skill sets and or lessons that you've learned in your career, or for anybody who's getting out, and if you apply that to living as a civilian now, or trying to start a business or figure things out, I think you will find that a lot of those things are required to be successful. I'm glad that you said some of the things you said. I think in terms of kind of doing things for the right reason, I think that's important. I'll also say that things like being happy and appreciating where you're at in life, because there are people who have achieved, you know, whatever their goal is, you know, they want to be a doctor or something, and they do it and they find that there's something missing, you know, they're not exactly satisfied. So I feel like, at least for me, like I've as human beings, we should continue to have an objective, figure out what we need to reach that objective, and continue to seek and understand. And I feel like that way you're always learning and you're always growing. And I feel like that's something that needs to happen in order for you to feel like it's worth living. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're not, especially people that have spent time in the military, we're very goal oriented. And, you know, having something that we're constantly working for, I mean, that's an important part of who we are. And it's important as a motivator to, you know, making ourselves the best version of ourselves we can be, whether that's chasing down a PhD or being able to squat 1,000 pounds or, you know, whatever it is. It's something that gives us purpose in life. And, you know, purpose is one of those things that you just can't, there's no replacing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and the, you know, the other thing is, and this is kind of to everybody, don't expect it to be easy all the time. Don't expect it to be fun all the time. You're allowed to be afraid. You're allowed to be frustrated. You're allowed to be, you know, everything. And you're going to be all of those things. You know, it's okay. It's okay on the first day that you're retired and you have no idea what to do to get shit faced. Yeah. It's not okay to do that every day.
Right.
It's okay to be situationally depressed. It's okay to wonder what the hell you're going to do now. It's But the, you know, and the thing about stuff like that, the thing about depression, the thing about, you know, the thing that drags people down, the biggest weapon that those feelings have is the, is convincing us that it's never going to get any better. And if you can realize that no matter what those feelings are telling you at the time, it will get better, then you've won 90% of the battle right there.
Yep.
So just again, maintain your purpose, maintain your, you know, figure, take the time to learn your operational environment, get with it, and then go for it.
Yeah, man, it's the struggle. I mean, the struggle is like, it's in our fibers, you know. I mean, back in the day, everything that was done was a struggle. I'm talking like wake up in the morning and you have to hunt, you have to gather vegetables or whatever. Like life was harder in the earlier days of existence, of human existence. And with the modernization of our society, things have become much easier, right? You can just order food. You can go to the supermarket. You don't have to hunt your meat anymore. You can, you know, everything is made available, readily available instantly. And I think that that takes away a lot of the struggle that our ancestors went through, which in a way it could be a good thing, but it's in a way I feel like it also kind of makes people lazy in certain regards. And I think being lazy can then certain lessons about life kind of go over your head, and things that you would notice if you were really working hard and working towards your goal or living the dream, so to speak, you kind of miss it completely. So, you know, it's just something to think about, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, man. So, you know, I had a good time doing this. I'm glad that you came on the podcast. You know, I appreciate you taking out the time to do this. You know,
oh, absolutely.
Like I said, you know, congratulations on your retirement. Wish you much success. And if you need anything, you know, that I can help with, just let me know, man. And also, if you want to come back on the podcast, let me know as well. I'd be happy to have you.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. That would be great. You know, thanks for having me on. Really, you know, I enjoy your podcast. I really, you know, I like what you're doing. You know, I think you have a lot of people out there who are paying attention to things only because they heard it from you. And that's, you know, it's important to keep people's eyes focused on what's going on out there. And I think you give people a voice that they wouldn't otherwise have. And, you know, if I can provide to that voice, if I can, you know, help pass some of the knowledge that, you know, that I've accumulated over my time in the service and my time on planet Earth, and it can help somebody else, whether it's someone just starting their career or just ending it or in the middle of it or whatever, then I'm more than happy to do that.
Awesome, man. Yeah, once again, thank you for coming on, and thank you for your service as well.
Of course, brother.
Leffler will be coming on a little more often to co-host some episodes and bring you guys some tangible information, things that'll help you survive a little better in certain situations, or things that'll help improve your day-to-day life, as he spent 20 years in the United States Army, the majority of that in special forces. And, you know, just give you guys things that you can really use to help you with your travels and things like that. So be on the lookout for Lef to be on the podcast a little more. As always, I encourage you guys to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Leave us a review. iTunes is for the Apple users, iPhones, and we have SoundCloud for Android users. On SoundCloud, just search Global Recon Podcast. Leave us a review. download it, share it with your friends and family. And that way we'll know that you guys are appreciating what we're doing, and we need to continue these efforts to bring you good content each week. My website is www.globalrecon.net. My Instagram account is IGRecon. The second account is Black Ops Matter. Chantel Taylor, my co-host, her military account is Mission_Critical. She wrote a very good book called Battle Worn, The Memoir of a Combat Medic in Afghanistan. Check it out. Available anywhere books are sold. The easiest place is probably Amazon. And check out Leffler on Instagram at forerunner.freja. So that's forerunner.freja. And he's posting pretty consistently on there. Anything he's got going on, you can keep up with him there. All right, we'll see you guys in a couple of days with another episode. Peace. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm.